The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
Hello, welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Alok Jha. This is our annual special podcast dedicated to those very famous Swedish prizes. Left in the will of the dynamite salesman Alfred Nobel, these prizes for physics, physiology or medicine, and chemistry are the pinnacle of any scientist's career.
Professor Peter Higgs at University of Edinburgh.
Physiology or medicine, jointly to James Rothman.
Nobel Prize in Chemistry to Thomas Professor Martin Karpis.
Joining me to chew over this year's prizes are a Nobel Prize worth of science journalism talent. We've got reporter Ewan Calloway from Nature magazine. Hello, Ewan.
Hello.
And my Guardian colleague, Ian Sample. Hello, Ian.
Hello.
So, grab a plate of meatballs, sit back in your IKEA chair and enjoy this Nobel edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. First up, the Nobel we were all waiting for.
Welcome to this press conference where we will present this year's Nobel Prize in Physics. This year's prize is about something very small that makes all the difference. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2013 Nobel Prize in Physics to Professor François Englert at Université Libre de Bruxelles, Belgique, and Professor Peter Higgs at University of Edinburgh, United Kingdom. And the Academy's citation runs for the theoretical discovery of a mechanism that contributes to our understanding of the origin of mass of subatomic particles, and which recently was confirmed through the discovery of the predicted fundamental particle by the ATLAS and CMS experiments at CERN's Large Hadron Collider.
That's right, Peter Higgs and François Englert were recognized for their brilliant insights in the 1960s into the nature of a fundamental field in our universe which produces that elusive little particle, the Higgs boson. Ian, this is the latest in that never-ending story of yours about the Higgs boson. What you must have been very excited at this moment.
I was genuinely really excited, actually, because I didn't obviously know he was going to get the prize. I mean, I fortunately have money on
because you're not on the Nobel committee
because I'm not on the Nobel committee, but yeah. A lot of people, you know, who have previously been on Nobel committees and a lot of scientists really did expect or at least hope that the prize would go to Peter Higgs and one or more of the other physicists who came up with the idea in 64. So it was a really exciting moment.
Give us a quick rundown for anyone who's been asleep for the past few years of what the Higgs field is, and then what François Englert, who maybe people haven't heard of as much as they've heard of Peter Higgs, where did he fit into this story?
Okay, so really, really simplified version of events is that the Higgs field is something which switches on in the very early universe after the Big Bang, so about a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. The theory goes that this field switches on, and when it does so, certain particles that have been previously massless, and when they're massless, they fly around at the speed of light. When the field switches on, certain particles feel the field, and the more they feel it, the more massive they get, and the more, and if a particle gets mass, it can't go at the speed of light anymore. So you get particles like quarks and electrons get their mass from the Higgs field, and quarks and electrons being the building blocks of atoms.
And so without this field, you know, atoms wouldn't clump together, you wouldn't be able to explain why the weak nuclear force inside atoms is different to the electromagnetic force, even though they're kind of the same thing, mathematically speaking. So it explains a lot of those things. And it was obviously Peter Higgs, we know, came up with this in 1964. Where does François Englert fit into it?
Well, François Englert and a guy called Robert Brout, both working at the Free University of Brussels at the time in 64, both published first, actually, on this idea. They published the idea which, with hindsight, gave you the field for how these particles would get mass. They didn't explicitly reference the new particle that would come with the field, and that's what Peter Higgs did in his second paper, the one that was famously rejected by an editor at CERN for having being of no relevance to physics.
Now, Harry Potter of his day, wasn't he, really?
Yeah, right. And but there was another team that published less than a month after Higgs's second paper, which was Jerry Guralnick, Richard Hagen, both in the US, and Tom Kibble at Imperial. They did a really extensive paper on this. Same idea, working independently.
And interestingly, it all happened in 1964. So the autumn of 1964, these papers were published sort of a month apart almost. And obviously there was something in the air in terms of what people were trying to solve. And it wasn't that they were trying to solve the mass mechanism anyway. They were trying to work out, was it the strong force, mechanisms for the strong force or something around that time? And these things came later. But before we go into that anymore, let's hear Peter Higgs's response. He did a press conference last week on Friday about how he heard about the prize, because he didn't make himself available to the Nobel Committee.
Curiously enough, I had the news when I was returning from my lunch in Leeds later in the afternoon, I was walking along Heriot Row and a car pulled up across the road near the railings. A lady in her 60s or maybe 70 or so got out and introduced herself as a former neighbour, widow of a judge who died recently, and congratulated me on the news. And I said, oh, what news?
Apologies for the poor quality of that clip. That was recorded at a press conference, and we just wanted to get some of Peter Higgs's voice in there. Ian, just to describe what happened on the day, before the announcement was made on the Tuesday, you already knew that he wasn't going to be around to hear it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have word from various people who know him pretty well to say, look, he's going AWOL. He's going to take himself away, leave his mobile phone at home. And just, he doesn't want to be around for this because he's had quite a lot of press interest. And this was one of those few Nobel Prizes where people since July last year could have said, well, he's likely to get it. So he'd been getting a lot of interest from the press already, and he doesn't particularly enjoy it. So he disappeared, basically, went off to have lunch down in Leith. And as you heard there, after lunch in Leith, he was walking back and a car pulled up and a woman came out and said, congratulations on the news. And he said, what news? And so...
What news? He yeah, knew what news.
That, I know, he's coy, isn't he? He was, that was how he found out. And I think that might go down as my favourite, how did you hear the news story from any Nobel laureate.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously didn't want the attention then. He wanted to control it to some extent. Ewan, this is... in terms of reactions, this prize was kind of expected. You never know 100% that someone is going to get any Nobel Prize whatsoever. But, as a general traveller in the world of science, I mean, how expected was this for someone like you?
As time went on, I came to realize that I had made a pretty foolhardy bet with Ian last year. First off, I want to apologize to Professor Higgs and to Professor Englert for betting against you last year.
They're going to hear this, and obviously, and they're going to hear your apology. But just remind us what you did.
Oh, so we were talking about last year's Physics Nobel, right? And it came, 2 months or so after CERN had basically confirmed the existence of the Higgs particle. And Ian kind of, proposed that next year, this year in 2013, the Nobel Committee would finally award Higgs with his Nobel, and I found that just improbable that, there's so many Nobel-worthy discoveries that don't get recognized. Just picking one, so I bet him £10, I believe.
Okay. So at some point, Ewan, you're going to have to settle up on this. But I mean, more seriously though, it's a deserved thing, even though it's rare that an award gets made so quickly after a discovery. But then again, you can argue it's 50 years since he actually made this prediction, right? So it's not like it's not too soon.
No, I don't think people will be questioning this award 50 years down the line. This was well deserved, expected, and egg on my face.
Let's not go so far. Ian, what about the response from his colleagues? I mean, there's not one person who's in any way been negative about this. You've been speaking to some people at CERN as well.
I spoke to Fabiola Giannotti, who was the head of ATLAS at the time that the Higgs boson discovery was announced. So she was one of the two scientists who gave the news to the world, if you like, that the Higgs boson had been discovered. And when I spoke to her the morning that the Nobel Prize was announced, she was absolutely delighted.
I was watching the webcast at CERN, and there was such a huge expectation, also because the announcement was a bit delayed compared to the scheduled time. So, of course, the suspense was raising, going higher and higher. And so it was really an amazing moment, a big, big joy.
Some of us have been getting our hopes up that CERN might share the prize, and I wondered if that was felt there.
You know, it's traditionally the Nobel Prize is given to individuals, and so I am not so sure that it can be given to institutions like CERN, and of course in the experimental world, these experiments are the results of the work of thousands of scientists, so it would be impossible to just identify a few of them, and three maximum would be really impossible. So, in some sense, I consider this prize to Higgs and Englert also given here 50 years after the time after the theory was developed, also a recognition that to the experimental work. And of course, I am so happy. I know Peter Higgs personally, and he's such a great scientist and a wonderful person. I think it's really great that he got the Nobel Prize.
Now, there's some people who would argue perhaps that CERN should have been recognised in the prize as well. Now, the rules are quite strict, are they, about whether or not you can award the Nobel to an institution? I mean, the Peace Prize goes to all sorts of institutions, and in fact, it was awarded to the Chemical Weapons Inspectorate just last week. Why couldn't CERN be recognised in this case?
They could have been. The rules are strict in the sense that they allow it. If you look at them, it says that it's up to the Nobel Committee, the relevant Nobel Committee, to decide for themselves whether they want to give it to an institution. So that's all it says. It's as simple as that.
And they didn't.
Well, the Nobel Medicine Committee has an internal rule that says it won't give it to an institution. But the other committees, the chemistry, physics, they can do it if they want. They do try and find an individual if they can. But something certainly that was open to them if they'd wanted to do it was to give split the award in half, give one half, if you like, to Englert and Higgs and the other half to CERN. They could have done that. That may have been what the hour delay was about before the prize was announced.
This is interesting. So the prize was meant to be announced at 10:45 London time. I'm using London time, but it was announced about an hour and a half late, something like that. Because was it because they couldn't find Higgs to tell him? They left a message about the chairman of the committee said that they tried to phone him on all the numbers they had. They couldn't contact him. Of course, we know why, because he was up a mountain somewhere, and so they've emailed him instead. That's all we knew at that point.
Yeah, and emailing Higgs is like you may as well just sort of shout up your sleeve, Peter, are you there? The amount he deals with email. But getting hold of Peter wouldn't have been any reason to delay the announcement. I mean, so
you reckon there's been some argument around things like whether to give it to CERN or something?
Yeah, I think because loads of prizes have been awarded without them getting in touch with the person who's getting the prize, not least the chap who was dead the other year.
Yeah, that's right, Ralph Steinman. And also, what about the three others who potentially missed out? You mentioned them earlier, Tom Kibble, Guralnik and Hagen, the Americans. They published a more complete version of the, let's call it the Higgs mechanism, in 1964, a month or so after Peter Higgs and co. They were more mathematically consistent, in fact, than the other two. So the other two papers. So, I mean, it's a real shame for them, surely.
It's tough. And they've suffered in history in terms of they delayed their paper to make sure it was really sort of all comprehensive and everything. But in that time, and due to, silly things like postal delays at Imperial and such like, they ended up getting hold of the papers from Brout and Englert and Peter Higgs, just as they were sort of putting their paper in the post, and they saw them and they realized that it was on the similar territory, same territory. So they then took the paper and put the references in and sent it off. And, now when people see their paper, they see Englert and Brout and Higgs referenced in the two papers, and they look at it and they say, well, it's derivative.
That was just those three being polite, I suppose.
They were doing the right thing in referencing the work. They
scientists
could have just ignored that and said, look, we didn't see that, and sent
it in the
post.
You don't win Nobel Prizes by being nice, clearly. That's the lesson here, isn't it, Ewan? they're all vicious, terrible people. No, that's not true at all. So those three could have been awarded, but of course you can't award the prize to more than three people. And in fact, Tom Kibble, who was incredibly gracious in his response, said, he congratulated the winners of the prize, but also said that he understood why the committee couldn't recognize him and his two colleagues, Guralnik and Hagen, because of their self-imposed rule. I thought it was about as catty as it gets, but he was really not very catty at all, was he?
There was a barb in that comment.
And, so classy.
But you know, I had a comment from one of the other authors, the American, one of the Americans, a guy called Richard Hagen, and he said that the committee had basically followed the rule book instead of going with a decision that would have been more even-handed. And perhaps the committee has its hands tied on that, but sooner or later you think that the Nobel guys have to do something to, you know, recognize that science isn't done the way it used to be done.
Well, and that's a good important question, isn't it? This is such an archaic way of awarding prizes, to be honest, isn't it? I mean, as much as we adore Higgs and Ongelaer and everyone, I mean, it's just not how you do science these days with two people.
Yeah. I mean, it is, particularly for physics, where you have these giant international collaborations like CERN, and even biology, where, you know, a paper that's published in Nature rarely has fewer than six or seven authors in it. So it's antiquated, but I suspect it won't change.
Not for a while anyway. And not while they're still awarding stuff that happened in the 60s and 70s, because there's quite a lot of stuff in between then that still has to be recognized. Ian, let's give the last word to one of Peter Higgs's longtime collaborators and friends. You spoke to Alan Walker, who's at Edinburgh University. What did you talk to him about?
Well, Alan was sat next to Peter at the CERN announcement of the Higgs boson in July 2012, and he's travelled around with Peter a lot. And I just asked him, before the prize was given, actually, for a piece I was doing, just what has Peter's contribution been to physics? And he had some interesting stuff to say about that.
I've been travelling with Peter for such a long time now, just helping out, that you get to know and you get to sense what Peter thinks, what he would say in those circumstances and so on. And the one thing you get from Peter is that he's his own person. So that I think in those days, in 1964, when he was writing this stuff, he was an independent thinker. He was able to not go with the flow and actually go against the flow. And as he says, his second paper in 1964, the first draft was rejected by Physics Letters, where the editor, our referee, was in CERN, which is ironic, and he rewrote it and submitted it to Physical Review Letters. He is quite a modest and almost shy sort of man, but if you actually get the physics wrong, he'll tear a shred off you. And not in the sense of being abusive, but he just is very robust about getting the physics right and so on. And so he was quite upset by that, which is why he resubmitted across the Atlantic. And there, of course, he writes in a little bit about, in these type of theories, there would be incomplete multiplets of massive vectors and scalars. And it's the Higgs boson, right? But even before he did that, if you look at the papers and compare the papers across, the 1964 paper of Englert and Brout, and then Peter's two papers, and then the one of Hagen, Guralnik, and Kibble, Peter is the one who explicitly has a mass term for the scalar boson. All of the guys were trying to do something which was actually look at spontaneous symmetry baking and actually applying it to what would be the strong interactions. None of them were, as is now the shorthand, were actually trying to use it for spontaneous symmetry baking to actually synthesize electromagnetism with the weak interaction. They weren't trying to do that. It was a development later that grabbed onto the Higgs mechanism and then actually becomes part of the standard model. But Peter, in terms of himself, he was always his stuff was quite challenging, but he was always, if you like, an individual thinker and so on. He didn't collaborate very much except with his postgraduates and so on. So he was, his own person. And he didn't produce a great deal, but what he did produce clearly is actually quite profound and is one of the keystones of what we now understand as the fundamental building blocks of nature.
So that was Alan Walker from Edinburgh University there, who was one of Peter Higgs's longtime friends and colleagues. Ian, is this the final full stop in the Higgs story now? What's next? Is he lecture tours, knighthoods? What's happening?
Well, he's got the trip to Stockholm in December, and the Nobel ceremony is always a strange event.
Do you reckon he'll turn up?
I think he will turn up. I'd love to see what his speech will be. He may, you know, I hope he doesn't, but one thing he might do is just modify a speech he's given lots of times, which is his speech is called My Life as a Boson. But I'm kind of fingers crossed he'll do something more exciting.
Well, when he was younger, he was a big advocate for campaign for nuclear disarmament, wasn't he? So he could sort of use it as a political platform. He's got nothing to lose now. He's done it all.
Yeah, but he left them when they sort of, you know, went off the rails a little bit and started going against nuclear power. Went off the rails as far as he was concerned.
All right. Thanks very much, Ian. Let's move on to our second prize. This is the Nobel Prize in Chemistry.
This year's prize is about taking the chemical experiment to cyberspace. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2013 Nobel Prize in Chemistry to Professor Martin Karplus at Université de Strasbourg, France, and Harvard University, Cambridge, Massachusetts, USA, and Professor Michael Levitt at Stanford University School of Medicine, California, USA, and Professor Ari Warshall at University of Southern California, Los Angeles, USA. And the Academy citation runs for the development of multi-scale models for complex chemical systems.
Now, this is a little bit of a crunchy subject to sort of try and get head around. So I spoke to Dominic Tildesley, who's the president-elect of the Royal Society of Chemistry and also a computational chemist himself, this idea of being able to simulate the reactions between molecules and maybe even create bespoke molecules for ourselves. And so Dominic took me through some of the processes involved and why it has been so important.
So that's exactly what it is about, bespoke design of molecules. What they've done is to take an area of science where you begin with a picture of the atoms and structure, the atoms of a protein. And then they ask the question, well, can we understand its structure? And we're going to try to understand that by doing a computer experiment. And the reason this is interesting is that you need to develop the forces between the atoms. And then when you've got an understanding of the forces, you could simply solve the equations of motion over a period of time.
This is classic Newtonian physics.
This would be classical Newtonian dynamics, yes. So once you've got the potentials between the atoms, that gives you the force, and the force gives you the acceleration, and you move the atoms forward. And then you can begin to ask questions about what is the structure of the backbone of the protein, what are the key angles which describe the way the protein moves, and its relationship to other objects, to the solvent and to small molecules binding to it in space. And you can do this, but let me just tell you, I make it sound easier than it really is, because you in order to solve these equations of motion, you need to move forward on very small time steps, yeah, of about 10 to the minus 15 seconds. And what you really want to do is to look at really quite long times, the time scales on which proteins really fold and adopt their structures. And this might be microseconds or even seconds. And when this work started in the early 1950s, the first computer simulations, there was no way that the computers we had then were going to be capable of doing this. But what these guys have done is to use the power of modern computers, the kind of petaflop, 10 to the 15 floating point operations per second, and very skillful and interesting new algorithms, and really interesting and accurate force fields, in order that we can now study these systems computationally.
What was chemistry like before these experiments, these equations and the computer simulations that these three laureates have
produced?
Well,
I think it relied very heavily on just the combination of really good quality experiment and theory. So it was, and they were quite often disconnected, because when one was doing the theory, if the theory was incorrect, one had no idea whether the cause of that was our understanding of the interactions between molecules, or the quality of the approximate theory we were using to make predictions about macroscopic properties. Now, that uncertainty has been taken out, yeah? And that means we can proceed with a great deal of confidence in making predictions about making predictions from the underlying microscopic behavior to the macroscopic or observable behavior in the laboratory. Because what we've done in doing these simulations is we've taken out the approximations in the theory.
I mean, in some senses, chemistry, the chemical reactions that were going on, you know, you mix things up, you see yeah. what happens. It's what was going on at the atomic level beyond just, you know, that these billiard balls of atoms were combining together, was a bit of a black box until...
Well, did you do chemistry as a subject?
A-level, a long time A-level. Ago.
Well, even at A-level, you may have done a bit of this, because when I was at university, we spent hours doing kind of arrow pushing of electrons, yeah? To look at organic reactions. And all of that was a black box. You're absolutely right. There was no theoretical justification for understanding those reactions. So there's been an enormous change in chemistry over the last 40 years in terms of putting some of those models, which we really didn't have a lot of confidence in, of putting them on a firm footing, yeah? And making them not just... In the past, they had the ability to rationalize what we saw. And now these models have gone beyond that. Because they're founded on proper theory, they become predictive. So we can begin to make predictions of what we haven't yet seen.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, would you be able to, at some point, using advanced versions of these models, would you be able to screen lots of drugs that don't even exist against
a
receptor?
Exactly right. And that goes on every day. And that is absolutely the stuff of these structure activities.
Without having to do the experiment itself?
Well, what you do, of course, is you take your set... You've got to have a model. So you have to make lots of correlations between experiment and the structure of the drugs. Yeah, and then you screen. When you've got that model, you can screen lots of drugs that you've never tried. And then what you might do, which would be smart, would be of those new drugs which don't exist, you might make 3 or 4 of them. Yeah, see how active they really are, and then add them to the training set. So add them to the set of data which you're going to use to build the model, and then go round and round in circles until you are improving the quality of the relationships.
Can I just ask about the prizes themselves? So last year, when the Chemistry Nobel Prizes were announced, they were given to 2 doctors for a particular sort of molecular process in cells. And there was some complaint amongst chemists that chemists themselves are not getting these prizes. It's all going to physics people and medicine people. These are genuine, hardcore chemists who've won this prize. Yeah. No doubt about it. What's your sort of overall reaction to that?
I'm really interested in giving out prizes for outstanding science, yeah? And I'm not partisan in terms of precisely which undergraduate degrees did these guys do. Are they really chemists? Are they 10% physicists? That for me doesn't matter. What matters is the real breakthrough. And what you have with these 3 guys is a tremendous breakthrough, yeah? So you have this third paradigm, the method of computational simulation, as a really underpinning method in the chemical sciences, or in all of the sciences, in physics, chemistry, material science, being recognized by the Nobel Committee. And that gives me huge pleasure.
Now, have you met any of the laureates?
I have indeed. I've met 2 of them at conferences. I wouldn't say I know them very well, but I've met Martin Karplus on several occasions. And I've met Michael Levitt, who's a Brit, which we should be very pleased about. Yeah.
What are they like?
They're fantastically hardworking. Dedicated guys, a pleasure to talk to. Really, in no sense is the stereotype of the mad scientist.
It's a good answer. So that was Dominic Tildesley, who's the President-elect of the Royal Society of Chemistry and a computational chemist, explaining the purpose and the designs of this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Now, Ewan, what is the... Give us some of the more sort of practical uses and things that this work that these 3 laureates have done. What have they enabled in modern chemistry and biology?
Well, I think this award is interesting because the Nobel Committee recognized that it was universal, that chemists studying all sorts of systems, solar cells, industrial reactions, etc., are using the computational methods they developed. But the researchers, they were really focused on biomolecules, proteins in particular, because these were, you know, the biggest, most unwieldy chemical reactions that people were studying at the time. And so Michael Levitt, in an essay he wrote for one of the Nature journals about a decade ago, really saw this work as the birth of computational biology, this field where you're studying biological reactions in computers so you don't have to do experiments. And this has become really important to do with predicting the shape of a protein. Now, the traditional way of doing this is to get the proteins to form a crystal and to bombard them with X-rays and look at how they diffract. It's really accurate. It's incredibly time-consuming. What would be amazing would be if you could take a protein sequence, which is kind of written in DNA, and predict how that protein will fold, what its three-dimensional shape. And the work that these three started is leading to that sort of things right now. In fact, some of the researchers did the first protein prediction.
Why is the shape of the proteins important, though?
Yeah, because the shape of a protein is what determines pretty much all of its chemical properties. Whether if it's an enzyme, its shape will allow it to perform the reaction that it does, whether it's making a biofuel or maybe even performing some useful task that could be a drug.
And the shape of a protein on the side of a cell, for example, will allow certain things in or out, and so you can obviously tailor the shape of a drug to sort of fit that lock and key mechanism, which leads me nicely, actually, into the next prize.
The Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institute has today decided to award the 2013 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine jointly to James Rothman, Randy Scheckman, and Thomas Sudhoff for their discoveries of machinery regulating vesicle traffic, a major transport system in our cells.
Biology seems to be a bit of a theme in the chemistry and the physiology medicine prizes this year. So the Physiology and Medicine Prize was awarded to Randy Scheckman, James Rothman, and Thomas Sudhoff for essentially between them over the 70s and 80s, working out how the various proteins and chemicals inside cells organize themselves to make the cells function. Ian, you spoke to one of the laureates, Professor Thomas Sudhoff.
I did. He was he got the news as he was driving to a conference down in Spain. He was just heading south of Madrid, and he got to his hotel and checked his emails, and one of them was from me, and luckily he was happy to have a chat. And he's a neuroscientist at Stanford, and he basically worked on how neurotransmitters are released from nerve to nerve across synapses, and how this happens so incredibly quickly and how it's orchestrated.
That is exactly the question that most fascinated me when I started this work 30 years ago. I was exactly interested in that particular question. I was interested in understanding how is it even possible? Because it's hard to imagine that something so complicated could be so fast, right? And indeed, for many people in the field 50 years ago, there was a certain disbelief that this actually happens, because many people argued, well, it's impossible, this can't happen. And the way this happens is that although it sounds complicated, in the end, it's very, very simple. It's simple because everything is set up like a well-oiled machine to work precisely in order to achieve that. So the actual signal is a chemical that is secreted by one cell and recognized by the other cell. That's the process. But the process of secretion is extremely fast and highly regulated. And that was one of the key questions that I addressed in my work and that I think we largely solved. Namely, how is it possible for a cell to secrete a chemical so rapidly with such precision? And in the end, it turns out that the underlying machinery is not that complicated. It's just a few proteins that work together to do it. And how they work and where they exactly are, that has been the target and goal of my work for much over the last three decades. Does that answer the question?
Perfectly. Had you been expecting the prize?
Not at all. And first of all, this is a field that I feel should be recognized. But the fact is
that there's many people who contributed. And I feel lucky that I was awarded the prize. However, I think that others may have deserved it just as much as I did. And I certainly didn't do any work in isolation. I did it together with many other people who contributed tremendously. So we always, I think, not only as scientists, as humans, I suppose, tend to overestimate ourselves. So I was hoping or dreaming that maybe I could get this award or that award, a little money here, a little money there. But I really did not expect to be awarded the prize, especially not right now. And so for me, that was an unbelievable, thrilling, and obviously beautiful surprise.
How's it going to change things for you?
I hope not much. I love what I do. I think that as a scientist, we have the luxury of really being able to pursue truth, which not many people are allowed to do. And I hope that I can do things maybe even more so in future that will actually also be of practical value. But primarily, I just want to pursue a better understanding of how the brain works and how it doesn't work in disease.
How are you going to celebrate today?
Well, so to be honest, I'm a little jet lagged because I didn't sleep last night. And so I'm hoping to have a wonderful dinner with my friends here and to go to bed early because it's been a long, I mean, usually when I travel overseas, I don't sleep and I go to bed early because I get very, very tired. And so I'll try to keep up a little longer. But I'm afraid if I had been in California, it would have been different. I would probably have had a wild party with all my lab. But I'm afraid my lab is going to have that party without me. Or they'll have to wait until I come back.
Congratulations again, and thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us, Thomas. It's fascinating and really lovely to hear you talk it through.
Thank you very much for listening.
That was In Sample talking to Professor Thomas Sudhoff there. And Professor Sudhoff was another one this year that the Nobel Prize Committee couldn't get in touch with before they made the announcement. So, you know, they left a message on his answer phone. And then when someone from Nobel Media, I think it was, interviewed him, that was when he found out. And that was quite a lovely moment, which they recorded, because he sort of just paused and said, "Oh, my God," several times. And had to say, and he said, "I've got to stop the car. I'm driving," which is very sensible of him. Ewan, this is squarely in your bailiwick. So give us the 101 on cell biology. These guys, Randy Scheckman, James Rothman, Thomas Sudhoff, did separate things to try and, as I said, essentially work out how the molecular traffic works inside a cell to make the cells work. So just give us the lowdown on what actually they discovered.
Yeah, the Nobel Committee kind of described their work as on a cellular shipping system in a shipping port, which I think is a pretty apt metaphor, because all eukaryotes, all the way from baker's yeast to humans like us, they have to move biomolecules such as proteins and hormones and neurotransmitters all around the cell from where they're made to different places and sometimes outside of the cell. And what these three researchers did in experiments that really spanned the 70s, 80s, and 90s was figured out how these molecules, which are packaged in little bubbles of fat called vesicles, how they know where they go and how they deliver their cargo, how they unload. And it's one of these things that it started with a bunch of open questions, and over three decades, they kind of built up an understanding of something that's textbooked, really. It's taught to biology students, to graduate students now, as if it's always been there.
So just give us what actually happens. So these little balls of fat essentially contain the neurotransmitter or hormone or whatever else, and they go from wherever they're made in the cell to the cell surface, and they burst, and the thing goes out, if it's a neurotransmitter, for example, what else? What are the examples of what actually goes on?
Yeah, I mean that's a fairly good example. I mean, let's talk about it in the case of a neurotransmitter. It's something that's synthesized by a series of enzymes that are in the cell, and then it needs to be secreted to another nerve that's outside of the cell. So it gets packaged in one of these vesicles, and somehow, which these scientists worked out, this vesicle containing the neurotransmitter finds its way to the synapse, which is kind of the edge of the cell, and then very quickly unloads its neurotransmitter and pops it out of the cell in response to outside signals.
And this is happening, of course, like I said, with many other of the chemicals and things. And it all happens in a very orchestrated way. There's no intelligent control of any of this stuff. It's just happening sort of, well, by chemistry and physics, essentially, isn't it, at that level?
Yeah. And it's kind of cool that the researchers who've done this have started working on started working on the genetics of it. What are the genes involved? Another worked on, like, can I get this to happen in a test tube? They started with that and end up kind of converging on the same molecules and systems. Now they're working on the physics of it. Like, how does this little bubble of fat, how does it interact with another layer of fat, which is the membrane, to spill out its contents so quickly. So it's been an amazing story of scientific progress.
So it's ongoing, of course. And just give us an example of the kinds of things you're able to do with this information. Why is this information useful?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this has been a struggle for us science reporters to explain, because this is a process that's so essential to all eukaryotic life. It's involved in everything, but this system is involved in the insulin secretion, so it goes wrong in diabetes. It's involved in synaptic transmission, which is neurons talking to each other. So it goes wrong in mental illness, neurodegenerative disease, and even autism. So it's inevitable that these systems are involved in lots of diseases, and we'll be able to find drugs, hopefully, in the pathways.
Am I right in thinking that someone pointed out, I think it was somewhere on the vast spaces of the internet, that the Botox injection is something that affects one of the neurotransmitters that these guys probably discovered? So that's a cosmetic surgery. Cosmetic procedures.
Yeah. Good of you, Alok, to bring it back
to the real world.
To the real world. Botox.
these cell, whatever they're called, vesicles, they're just, airy fairy nonsense to most people. No, I'm joking, of course.
But I can explain that if you want.
What? The Botox? Please
yeah.
do.
Yeah. Which explains why you're smiling so much. So Botox, which is a toxin produced by this nasty bacteria called Clostridium botulinum, it blocks these synaptic vesicles. So these vesicles, these bubbles of fat that contain neurotransmitter, and that's how it silences neurons, by blocking this pathway. And actually, Botox, or this toxin, was instrumental in working out some of the steps.
Oh, so there you go. So it was actually a very useful scientific thing. Now then, we've come to the end of our 2013 Nobel Prize. Well, the Science Nobel Prize descriptions. It's been a good year for the prizes. All white men, unfortunately, for us. You don't get many women winning physics Nobel Prizes anyway. There's only been two, but even in the other ones, sometimes there have been. But that's a record that is going to be interesting to keep watching. Bearing in mind that these things happen decades after discovery. So maybe it'll be a few more decades before that changes. Ian, do you have any predictions? What would you like to see the next year or so? I don't want to say 2014, but Ian, go on. Give us any of your predictions for any of the science prizes. And also maybe a wish for how the prizes themselves might be different in terms of who they're awarded to or the way they're awarded.
One wish I have on the way the prizes are awarded, apart from the really fundamental stuff. I mean, we could have a big debate about whether these prizes should go to more than three people and whether that would erode the kudos of the prizes, so on and so forth. But I wasn't going to talk about that. I mean, I just noticed that this year, apart from all the winners being white old men, only the physics laureates did not work at a US lab. So Higgs and Englert were the only two who did not have a US lab. And I think that's...
Or any lab, for that matter.
Or any lab, they're retired, right? And I think that's one to watch. I mean, I think, you know, the Asian countries are going to start coming in. I mean, but bear in mind, Ewan's been saying, as we've been saying, a lot of these prizes are for work that has been happened over decades ago.
Bear in mind, though, that physics, though, has had a lot of Japanese laureates as well. I mean, the Japanese are very instrumental in theoretical physics.
Yeah, right. But I think we're going to see more of that. And it'd be nice for the balance to see a bit more of that.
Yeah, but what's your predictions?
Well, I think some of the ones that have come up recently as predictions out there, they're not particularly exciting. I think it would be fair to look at people like Jeff Marcy and some other people for exoplanets. I think it would be really fair to look at people like Anton Zeilinger for entanglement.
You want to go to double or nothing on that?
Oh my God!
You've
learned nothing.
£20.
Ewan, you've learned nothing. So I'm gonna save you from yourself.
Thank you. Thank you.
Give us some of your wishes, predictions.
Wishes, predictions. Biology is so diverse. There are so many deserving projects, but one that I think a lot of us are watching, and I don't think next year will be the year, but I think it's going to be rewarded soon, is optogenetics, which is kind of this tool that a few scientists in the U.S. invented to be able to control neurons with light. It's been a hugely powerful tool, and it continues to be, and I think a lot of people think it's a matter of time.
This is the ability to control genetic function using laser light, essentially, so you can actually do research very, very precisely and accurately.
Yeah, yeah.
Into what those things are doing.
Yeah, you can control a neuron and see. You say, "Oh, I think the neurons in this area are implicated in depression," and you could take, you know, you can actually put that to the test in mice.
That would be Ed Boyden, wouldn't it, and Carl Disseroth.
Exactly.
Who would be the winners of that? Anyone else you would sort of say for the next few years? What about the Human Genome Project? Is anyone going to get a Nobel for that ever?
That's an interesting one. I think they've been on a lot of short people's list, the Human Genome Project, and
you've been on lots of people's short list, not short people's list. I think is what you meant.
The Human Genome Project and the private effort led by Craig Venter have been on a lot of people's list, but for a long time. And so you wonder if that opportunity has passed them by. I mean, I think, you know, the projects are continuing to show that they made a huge impact in science, but you know, a lot has.
Has a prize been given for knockout?
Yeah. I think there was one developed for the techniques that led to knockout mice a few years ago. So that's a big one.
And just explain what knockout mice are.
Knockout mice are mice that have been genetically engineered that lack a specific gene. Hugely powerful tool that's changed the way that people do biology.
Okay, my prediction, I always say this. John Pendry, Imperial College London, metamaterials. This is he's the theoretical physicist who came up with the idea, did the mathematics for negative refractive index, which might sound esoteric, but this has kind of been used now to build essentially invisibility cloaks. Not only is that an exciting news story for us, but it is just another domain of physics, essentially, which he's created. And he's such a, I've never worked with him, so I don't know what he's like to work with, but he's a lovely, humble, nice man, and incredibly sort of kind, generous, and lovely. So it would be lovely for him to get it, and he would be sort of there as a one-off winner. You know, I don't think he'd have to share it with anyone particularly, but you know, I'd love him to win that prize at some point. One final question for you guys: is it still heartening for the science community that these prizes get so much attention, or do you think that we give it too much attention? I mean, it is a bit of a media construct to some extent, the way it's announced, the secrecy, all that stuff.
I think without doubt we give it way too much attention. But I think it's nice to have science stories on the front page of newspapers for a week and people talking about it. It's certainly better than reading about the U.S. government shutdown.
Well, and talking about very esoteric science as well. I mean, not esoteric, but very basic fundamental science you'd never normally talk about. There's no way you talk about computational chemistry or these cell vesicles and things in any newspaper article, really, but you've got an excuse to do it, so in that way. And never mind the Higgs mechanism. I mean, God, we've done acres of stuff on that. I mean, I suppose with the physics prize, Ian, this was a ready-made thing, and we'd kind of been talking about it for so long, people were sort of prepared for it already.
And let's, you know, get it right in a way, and that the reason these stories, or when these stories get a lot of press coverage in the UK, and when they end up on the front of the page, it's because of the person who's got the prize. It's not because of the actual sort of, you know, it's not because of the science particularly or the prize. Well, the prize is your peg, but think of John Gurdon last the year before, who, you know, the Cambridge scientist who did work on reprogramming cells. He made a lot of news in the UK because when he was at Eton, he was told by his schoolmaster that he had no hope of being a scientist and that he should just ditch all his ambitions. And he kept that school report up on his lab wall. And because he was such an extraordinary character, I think that's why, you know, it's the people that make the stories.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ian and Ewan, for that. Well, Ewan, you can come back next year, or maybe before, even if you fancy it. But definitely next year to give. I don't know. Did you make a bet this year? I don't know what happened in the end.
Not yet. But I've got 40 pounds.
There's some sort of strange addiction to gambling that Ewan has, which we won't
record
this year.
Don't make me go to Ladbrokes.
All right. Well, thank you very much, both of you, for discussions this year. This has been an excellent production of Science Weekly this year. And if you want to know more about any of these prizes, you can go to theguardian.com/science. And also, by the way, it's worth pointing out that our very own Robin McKee, who couldn't make it to this podcast, unfortunately, was the very first journalist to interview Peter Higgs, or so he claims anyway, back in 1987, where he said he'd been to CERN, he was wandering around and everyone was talking about the Higgs boson, so he thought he'd go and interview Peter Higgs. Apparently Peter Higgs sort of didn't know why on earth he was interested in what he was talking about, but there he is, Robin McKee. When you've been around as long as him, then you're going to have interviewed all these people, aren't you? But as a fellow Scot, yeah, I think he's very pleased with the awards. Thank you very much to everyone in the podcast. I'm Alok Jar. This podcast was produced by Jason Phipps. Goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.